Thank you. That would have been a good idea, but yeah, no, I didn't want to carry them all down here. But yeah.
Oh, that's.
Well, why not? Try to find something to hold this thing up a little higher, but because I'm going to read off the screen. But I can't find it, like a little book or something.
How about a couple of those slides?
Maybe that'll do it. Yeah. We'll see what happens. I've always got a printout I can use if I have.
I'll sit here. Titled recently, Peter has served as a member of the California Judicial Council charged with improving California jury instructions, the new ones of which were approved in the summer of 2005, which is a fairly significant achievement. I am very proud to present the president of the International Association of Forensic Linguists, Peter Gisman.
Thanks very much, and thanks very much for having me here. As Professor Kaplan said, I'll be talking today about language and crime, and it will be based, at least to some extent, on this book that I've co-authored with Larry Solon at Brooklyn Law School, who, like me, has a PhD in linguistics and also a JD. So just to get that out of the way. I've been interested in language and law, actually, for quite a while, going back to my high school days. In fact, sort of went back and forth as to whether I wanted to be in linguistics or law. When I got to high school, guidance counselors there told me that, well, if you want to be a lawyer, you should take Latin. So I took Latin for a couple of years. And, in doing that, I actually found that the language pretty interesting. And I was interested in the connections between Latin and other Romance languages and so forth. So when I went to Stanford as an undergrad, I decided I'd pursue languages. They didn't have an undergraduate linguistics major at the time, but they did have German studies, and speaking Dutch and Frisian, which are related to German, I ended up getting a degree in German studies. While I was at Stanford, I took a popular course, an undergraduate course on criminal law. A whole lot of students took that, and one of the requirements of this course was that you had to go on a ride-along with a member of one of the local police departments. We got a list of police departments to call, and I called up Sunnyvale, which is a little south of Palo Alto, and arranged to go on a ride-along on a particular day, starting at about midnight, actually, with this police officer. And we spent the next hours until daybreak cruising around the peninsula area, up by the Bay Area, looking for bad guys and illegal activity. Didn't find too terribly much, but around 2 or 3 in the morning, he stopped a car full of 4 or 5 young Latino men, older car, one of his old 50s cars, for having a broken license plate light. And instead of giving him a citation for having the broken license plate, he collected all of their driver's licenses, and he came back to the cruiser where I was sitting, and he wrote them all down in index cards, which he kept in a little box. And he explained to me that the whole point of this was not to cite them for the light. You see, if he cited them for having a broken license plate light, they would fix it, and he wouldn't be able to stop them again on these minor traffic violations. He simply let them go with a warning. They wouldn't get it fixed. And then if there was a crime in the area, these guys seemed like possible suspects, or at least they might know who was involved, and so I'd be able to stop them again and question them about it. Rather interesting practice. Well, why am I telling you this? About 10 years later, I was attending law school at Bolt Hall in Berkeley. And at one point, at this point, I assumed that I would become a lawyer. And was taking a course in criminal procedure. As part of that course, I had to read a case, a United States Supreme Court case called Schneckloff versus Bustamante. And as a result of reading that case, along with some other cases and so forth, I began to become very interested again in language, began to see that there were some very interesting linguistic issues in the law. So let me tell you first a little bit about this case, Schneckloff versus Bustamante. It was early in the morning, about 20 or 30 years ago, and Joe Gonzalez, along with 5 friends, including Robert Bustamante and Joe Alcala, was driving a car in the San Francisco Bay Area, very close to Sunnyvale, actually. And a police officer stopped the car after observing a broken headlamp and a broken license plate light. Now, Mr. Gonzalez, the driver, couldn't produce a driver's license. In fact, the only person who had a driver's license was Joe Alcala, one of the passengers. And for reasons that aren't entirely clear from the record, the police were not all that terribly interested, actually, in that broken headlamp and the license plate light. They were interested in having a look in the trunk of the car. Now, unfortunately for them, they did not have any legal basis for a search. So they did what police very often do in this situation. They requested consent for a search. And the way they did that is in your handouts in number one, where the officer says, "Does the trunk open?" And the suspect doesn't say anything, just opens the trunk. Inside, the officers found three stolen checks, and largely on the basis of those stolen checks, Mr. Bustamante ended up being convicted of possessing a check with intent to defraud, which is a crime, apparently. Anyway, he appealed his conviction, and he argued that the search of the trunk violated the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. The case eventually made its way to the United States Supreme Court, which held that it did not, in fact, violate the Fourth Amendment. The court basically said that even when police have no other basis for making a search, they can always request consent. And if the person who controls the property freely and voluntarily consents to the search, then it's constitutionally valid. Now, to decide whether a defendant freely and voluntarily consented to the search, the court says you have to look at what it called the totality of the circumstances, which would include things like their age and their level of education and things like that. And also, it included whether they had been advised of their right to refuse. But the court said that is not critical. That's simply one of the mix of things that you look at. So this knowledge of the right to consent was simply a factor, but not dispositive. And applying that standard, the court held that the police in this case had requested the right to search the trunk and that Mr. Bustamante's friend, in opening it, had consented to the search. Now, Bustamante is unusual because here the person who consented, Mr. Alcala, was not the driver of the car, and he also was not the person who possessed the contraband. He may not, in fact, have had any idea that there were stolen checks in the car. Nonetheless, every day there are a large number of people who consent to searches just like this one when they must know that they've got drugs or illegal weapons or some other evidence of illegal activity in the trunk. And the abiding conviction, the abiding mystery of these cases is why in the world would they do that if they have the right to say no? It seems to me that the solution to that mystery is, at least to some extent, a linguistic one. And let me explain why. Literally, the police in the Bustamante case simply asked about the capacity of the trunk to open, right? Does the trunk open? Never directly asked permission to search the trunk. But Mr. Alcala's response in finding the key and opening it indicates that he clearly understood this in context as being a request or maybe an order to open that trunk. And of course, this, I think it's consistent with linguistic research on pragmatics and especially on indirect requests and demands. The best known example is where you're sitting at a table with someone and you ask them, "Can you pass the salt?" Right? And if someone says yes or no, that's usually a joke, right? The appropriate response is to hand them over the salt. That's not merely a question about your ability to do so. And in the same way, does the trunk open in context is not just a question about the ability of the trunk to open, but at least an indirect request to open it. And it's interesting, the Supreme Court had absolutely no difficulty seeing that point. It doesn't even mention it. Simply says, well, the officer requested consent to search the trunk, and never even considered, at least not in the written opinion, the fact that the officer never directly did that. He simply asked whether the trunk opened. Now, as a legal matter, once you've got this consent, it is important that the consent be voluntary. And so it's essential to the court's reasoning that police officers requested permission to search the trunk and that they didn't order or demand the person to open it, because in that case it would not be consent which would allow a constitutional search. And the court's not dumb. I mean, if you follow the orders, if you've got a police officer with his gun out saying, can I search, they've held those to be invalid, right? That's obviously not voluntary consent. I think, though, that the problem with the Supreme Court's analysis is that although they recognize that does the trunk open could function as a request of some sort, they failed to go the step further and to consider whether it might also not be an order or a command, which would make it unconstitutional, because following the orders of a police officer is never voluntary. Now, I think as most of us know, it can be difficult at times to tell the difference between speech, a request and a command. We can issue commands by using speech acts like I order you to, I command you to, right, that I direct you to, that sort of thing. Or we can do it by using imperatives, get out of the car, put your hands up, you know, that sort of thing. But sometimes what sounds like a command might actually be a request. So if the dentist tells you, open your mouth, right, even though it's an imperative, it's actually a request. You have every right to say no. On the other hand, we sometimes also make commands indirectly. Right? So if the boss tells the secretary, can you type this memo, that's not really a question. That's an order to type the memo. Now, consider also when a police officer pulls over a car, some of you may have had this happen, and says, may I see your driver's license? Right? Technically, that looks like a request. May I? It's a prototypical request. Do you have the right to refuse? It is a misdemeanor in California not to show your driver's license. So effectively, that is a command, right? Even though it sounds like a request, it in fact is a command. No is simply not an appropriate response. Well, what if the police officer now instead goes to a restaurant near closing time and says, you know, may I see the menu? And the waitress says, no, sorry, we closed 5 minutes ago. Well, once again, may I, right? May I see the menu? Now, I think the waitress doesn't have to be worried in this situation that she's going to get arrested for not following the order, right? Clearly, that's not an order. That really is a request. It's a different context. He's now in a restaurant and so forth. But the question then becomes, how can we tell the difference? Because linguistically, of course, they're very similar. And as most of us know, pragmatics here, the power relationship between the parties and so forth, makes an awful lot of difference. As John Searle has pointed out, if the general asks the private to clean up the room, that is in all likelihood a command or an order. If the private asks the general to clean up the room, that is likely to be a suggestion or proposal or request, but not an order or command. So getting back to request to search, it seems to me it's highly relevant here that the search is being made by a police officer who's exercised his authority, his lawful authority, stopped the car, and who at least seems to have the power to force someone to comply. It seems to me that a request under these circumstances is very likely to be interpreted as a command. And in fact, the Ninth Circuit, in the Bustamante opinion, the one that was overruled by the Supreme Court, recognized this when they said, quote, under many circumstances, a reasonable person might read an officer's may I as the courteous expression of a demand backed by force of law. They had a little more pragmatic sophistication, I think, than the Supreme Court did. Now, it's worth noting that very often when officers ask or request search, they do it using the stereotypical language, may I search the vehicle, may I look into your car, may I search your bag. These are all from actual cases. But think about this. Those sound like requests, right? You can see that the Supreme Court might say, well, those are certainly requests. But remember that may I see your driver's license, right, which happened a few minutes probably before that, is effectively a command. You cannot say no. Whereas may I search your trunk, according to the Supreme Court, why everyone knows that you can say no and you don't have to do it. Well, how in the world is the ordinary person supposed to know the difference? Because linguistically, they're pretty much identical. Now, these so-called requests to search are actually even more coercive when officers use the phrase, do you mind? And there are some actual examples in handout two, number two in your handouts. Would you mind if I took a look around here? Or do you mind if we search your vehicle? Or, well then, do you mind if we search the trunk? All held to be valid consent when the person said, no, that's one thing you know. How do you respond to a do you mind, right, formulation? Well, you consent by saying no, right? No, I don't mind. That in itself is confusing. And I think the other thing that is objectionable about the do you mind formulation is that it seems to put the burden on the detained person to articulate an objection, right? Do you mind? And generally, the notion is you're expected to come up with some reason why it should not take place. And most people can't find it difficult to articulate a reason. Well, I have drugs in the trunk, that's why. You know, obviously that's not what you're going to be saying. So it's hardly a neutral way to request permission, but in all of those cases, the resulting consent was held to be voluntary. Now, I don't know how, there's also something I call the Colombo technique, and I'm not sure how prevalent this is, but this comes from an Ohio case where an officer in court explained, and I'm quoting now, I completed the traffic citation, gave the citation to her driver's license and her vehicle registration back to her, and as part of my technique, I then continue on the conversation in a casual manner. I say, you're not free to go, or you can go ahead and take off, or whatever the case may be. At that point, as I was taught, the suspect would turn back to her vehicle. As soon as she turned back and took one step, I said, excuse me, can I ask you one more thing before you go? And at that point, she said, sure. I said, are you carrying any large sums of money, drugs, or other weapons? She stated, no, I'm not. I said, would you mind if I search your vehicle and contents to be sure there's no contraband? And she said, sure, go ahead. Now that sure, of course, is really not, she should have said no. But anyway, that's the confusing thing about do you mind. And the deputy testified that one year he had asked a request to search around 800 times during routine traffic stops, using apparently this technique that he had learned. Now notice that here you have some additional problems, not just the would you mind formulation, but after asking someone, do you have contraband, they say no, and then the next question is, do you mind if I check, you're at least weakly primed to say no again. I don't think too strongly, but there's at least some aspect to that. And I think more importantly, you now have, in a sense, psychologically staked your reputation on there not being anything in the car. And at that point, it becomes extremely difficult when the policeman says, do you mind if I check, to refuse to allow him to have a look. All in all, I think it's a very problematic area. It's hard to say whether having a rule that requires that the police tell you have the right to say no and you can be on your way if you do, it's hard to say whether that would help just because the whole situation tends to be very coercive. But in any event, the Supreme Court has held repeatedly that the police do not have an obligation to tell you what your rights are in the situation and that you have the right to refuse. They've essentially closed their eyes to the possibility that these so-called requests to search, in fact, are being understood. Whether or not they're intended, I don't know, but they certainly are being understood by the drivers as functionally being commands. There's another area where the courts, and especially the U.S. Supreme Court, have been very literal-minded and have tended to ignore pragmatic information. And this is when suspects who are being interrogated request a lawyer. They have the right to consult a lawyer during interrogation, called the right to counsel. Now, not too long ago, the United States Supreme Court considered one of these cases, Davis versus United States, during interrogation, where a suspect said, what's in your handouts on number 3, said, maybe I should talk to a lawyer. And the police ignored him and kept on questioning him. And when it ended up before the United States Supreme Court, they held that, in fact, he had not invoked his right to counsel. And it also held that police officers, you could argue maybe it's ambiguous that police officers ought to ask, right? But they said police officers have no obligation to ask clarifying questions, that a suspect must make an unambiguous or an equivocal request for counsel. And otherwise, police can just keep right on questioning. Now, unfortunately, you know, as we've seen, people do not make requests that directly. They don't tend to speak as unequivocally as the Supreme Court seems to say. We've seen that people very often make requests indirectly. They often do it, for example, for politeness reasons. One way to make a request more polite is by hedging. And one way you hedge is by saying, adding maybe or perhaps, like perhaps you could move your chair out of the way, right? Or maybe you could do this or that, which functions as a polite request. You can also sometimes mitigate the force of an utterance by throwing in things like, I think, right? Rather than asserting something directly like, that's right, you can say it a little more politely by saying, well, I think that's right. Politeness, of course, is especially important when you're talking to someone who is in a position of power over you, as people who are being interrogated definitely are. So it's very natural, I think, for people who are being interrogated, who are in police custody, to say something like, maybe I should talk to a lawyer. There are some other examples on a handout in number 4, and all of these also have been held not to be requests for counsel. Wait a minute, maybe I ought to have an attorney, or I think I might need a lawyer. Or didn't you say I had a right to an attorney, right? all of those, as I said, were held not to be... In my book, I have a little fun with this, because I say, imagine you're in a restaurant, and you say to a waitress, maybe I'll have the salmon, right? And then half an hour later, nothing has come. Wouldn't you be a little annoyed? Or said, I think I'll have the salmon. And then the waitress goes, and you know, you come back, no salmon. She said, well, you never requested salmon. You just said you thought you'd have it. that's what happens here. And of course, people don't speak quite that directly in ordinary life. Judges clearly are ignoring a lot of what could broadly be called pragmatic information, or are being what we might call very literal-minded. Now, it turns out that they aren't always that literal-minded. When it comes to language crimes, threats being a good example, judges seem to have a lot less trouble taking into account pragmatic information in the overall context and deciding what a suspect meant by an utterance. Consider the example number 5 in your handout by a young man named David Hoffman, who sent this letter to the White House during the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Ronnie, listen, chump. Resign or you'll get your brains blown out. Well, is this a threat? I mean, literally, it's nothing but a prediction, right? And he's not saying that he's going to do it. It's in the passive voice. Someone else is going to do it. He's just trying to warn the president for his own good that he ought to resign because an idiot out there might blow his brains out. Well, that's not how the court took it, right? He was sentenced to 4 years in prison, and the Court of Appeals affirmed it. Or consider the letter sent by a man to a woman. Yeah, they dated during high school, and then she'd gone off and married another man and had a family with him. And he then sent her this letter on handout, on number 6 in your handouts. Your husband, David Goldstein, will have his health take a turn for the worse this Christmas season, and you will be widowed in 1990. I am truly sorry for this que-sera-sera scenario that has to take place. Just a prediction that the husband will die? Well, that's not how this woman and her husband took it. And but it's interesting, the trial court said that this letter and a couple of other similar communications were so vague that they dismissed the charges against them before it went to the jury. But on appeal, the court said a jury could very well decide this is a threat, and they sent it back and said, well, let the jury decide. Courts also have not hesitated to find that you can make threats by means of gestures, for example. So there's a case of a rape case where a man held his hands around a woman, didn't, you know, choke her or anything, but that was held to communicate a threat of violence in case she didn't do what he wanted her to do, and he was convicted. Case in California where a question was held to be a threat. This is in your handouts in number 7, where a litigant before a court sent a letter with a question. And this is out of the opinion in that case, where it said the concluding words of his letters to Judges Swain, Smith, and Hull are not such as to be a simple inquiry into the state of the insurance of the respective windows. We think that the words, "are all the windows insured," as used in context with the remaining parts of the letters and considering all the other facts and circumstances, would well be adapted to imply a threat to do damage to the respective judges or to their property. Well, it's not surprising that people speak indirectly when they're committing or when they're plotting language crimes, right? It gives them a chance later to try to deny that the statement was in fact a threat. Politicians do this all the time. They call it plausible deniability, right? You make vague statements and then deny you really meant what it might seem to imply. And of course, within the area of most language crimes, generally recognize this. But it's equally true, it seems to me, that as a practical matter, people, when they're making requests, for example, tend to do so by using politeness strategies like hedging and so forth. And for some reason, courts have been much more reluctant to recognize this reality when it comes to requests to search or requests for counsel. And Larry Sullivan and I, in our book, talk about this as selective literalism. Now for a brief commercial message. For more on this book, you can go to www.speakingofcrime.org. We return to our future presentation. Okay, well, anyway. It seems to me that, I couldn't resist a little plug, but it seems to me that in all of these situations, judges ought to consider the pragmatic context, right, regardless of which they are. But unfortunately, Supreme Court decisions have been rather tough in the area of criminal procedure recently. They're not very promising. And maybe the best bet is that we can educate lawyers on the trial court level before it goes on appeal to explain this to judges and have a sympathetic judge realize that this really was a request for counsel or whatever. You know, suppose that a judge says, you're a lawyer, a judge says to you, I've suggested this to the lawyers once or twice. So you've got a judge who says, well, maybe I should talk to a lawyer. That's not a request for a lawyer, right? It says maybe. And then maybe a linguistically sophisticated lawyer would then say, well, Your Honor, what if someone said to you, maybe I should blow your brains out? Isn't that a threat? And I think you could make the point to the judge in a perhaps overly graphic, but nonetheless pretty effective way that word maybe doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't always literally mean perhaps. Now, there's another language crime that raises some interesting issues, similar issues, but with an interesting twist, and this is the crime of perjury. Roughly speaking, perjury is lying while testifying in a courtroom. Of course, lying normally is not a crime, but it is a crime if you are under oath. So the elements of perjury are that the witness must be under oath, and in addition, the speaker must state or subscribe any material matter, which he does not believe to be true. And that second requirement is very often referred to as the false statement requirement. So basically speaking, you have to make a false statement under oath. But what does it mean for a statement to be false? Well, that was the topic of a case called Bronston versus United States. The defendant was a guy named Samuel Bronston, and he was the president of a movie production company that at some point ran into money difficulties. He had personal as well as company bank accounts in various places in Europe. And at some point, his company petitioned for bankruptcy. Now, during the bankruptcy procedure, lawyers for the creditors are allowed to place you under oath and examine you about all of your assets to find out where your assets are. And this happened to Mr. Bronston, and the exact colloquy is in your handouts on number 8. Do you have any bank accounts in Swiss banks, Mr. Bronston? Answer, no, sir. Have you ever? Answer, the company had an account there for 6 months in Zurich. Now, it turns out that Mr. Bronston had a large personal bank account in Switzerland. Right? So, did he lie? The lower court, the trial court, held yes, he did. And then it ended up before the U.S. Supreme Court, which reversed and held that he could not be convicted of perjury. Now, this actually, there's an awful lot in this a fair number of people have talked about this little colloquy, and there's a lot to it. One of the issues is the ambiguity of you here, which could refer just to Bronson personally, but could also refer to you and your company, right? So the Supreme Court assumed for its analysis that you referred only to his personal account. So let's start out by looking at it as referring just to you personally. So essentially the question would have been, have you ever had a personal bank account in Switzerland? And the answer is the company had an account there for a while. But he doesn't say anything about his personal account that he had. Now that answer certainly is misleading, I think, on some level. It seems to have misled the lawyers for the creditors because they didn't ask any further questions about it. But the Supreme Court said that for a witness to mislead someone, and even if it's intentional, does not constitute perjury. You have to have made a false statement. And so they said Bronson's answer here is unresponsive, it doesn't directly respond to the question, but literally true. And they held that any answer that is unresponsive but literally true cannot form the basis of a perjury conviction. Anyway, that established what's called the literal truth defense in perjury. The problem is that it's actually rather unnatural to interpret language, especially in these sorts of question-answer sequences, quite as literally as the Supreme Court seems to suggest. Have a look at the handout, number 9 there in the handout. Question, I wonder if our neighbor Bill is home. Answer, his car's in the garage and his lights are on. I think Grice has an example, something like this. At any rate, it seems to me that that answer, you could say is just totally unresponsive, right? But it seems to me that most of us are going to take it as at least giving some information relevant to the question, right? That at least it suggests that Bill might be at home. And that, of course, relates to Grice's maxim of relations, that you need to make your contribution relevant to the proceedings or to the exchange. Now notice, as I said, the answer in number 9 is technically unresponsive. Nonetheless, so the speaker seems to, the person who gave that answer seems to have violated Grice's maxim by not saying something that's responsive, right? Because you're supposed to say something relevant. And the other interesting aspect, most of you are on linguistics, you all know this, but the other very interesting aspect, maybe the most interesting aspect of Grice's maxims, is that we also use them to interpret what other people say under the assumption that they are being cooperative and following these maxims. And that, of course, is what we do here. We generally look at the answer, and in order to make sense of that, in order to make it relevant, the only way really to do that is as suggesting that there's some indications that he might be at home. Now, it's also interesting that a clever person can exploit these sorts of principles to make statements that are true in isolation, but that are intended to mislead or deceive or maybe even to lie. And an example would be on number 10 in your handouts. Do you have a Chevy? Answer, I have a Ford. Truth is, the witness has both a Chevy and a Ford, right? Well, technically, the answer is unresponsive. The question was about a Chevy, right? And the answer is literally true because the person has both a Chevy and a Ford, but it is highly misleading, right? And the reason, of course, is you're going to try to make that answer relevant to the question. And the only way to do that is to assume that what the speaker is trying to say is, I don't have a Chevy, I have a Ford. But it would fall under the Supreme Court's literal truth defense, even though it seems to be intended to mislead. Now, why would courts be so literal-minded with perjury when we've seen that with other language crimes, threats and conspiracy and solicitation and so forth, they almost always take pragmatics into account? I think the answer is, at least this is what the Supreme Court in Bronson suggests, the reason is that because we're normally in the courtroom where the lawyers are in charge of all the discourse, basically, that it is really up to the lawyers to clarify any possible ambiguities or uncertainties. That it is the court says it's their job to pin down the wily witness and to probe more deeply in order to figure out what's actually going on here. So if an answer is unresponsive, it's the lawyer's job to probe more deeply and figure out, you know, and make the witness. So if someone says, if the question is, do you have a Chevy? Answer is, I have a Ford. The lawyer says, no, wait a second, that's not what I asked you, right? And pin him down and find out whether he actually is, if he evades, pin him down on that issue. And that, in fact, most lawyers are fairly good at doing. However, what if you can't tell that an answer is unresponsive? I mean, most of the ones now, you can tell if they're unresponsive. And that's in number 11, an example of your handout. Why didn't you come to work today? Answer, I was horribly sick yesterday. Truth, I felt wonderful. I went fishing. Drank too much beer while I was fishing, and then by evening, I was horribly sick. Okay? Now, notice the answer is well, you know, it seems to be responsive, right? It's at least somewhat responsive, and it is literally true, and there's no way to tell. Well, it seems to be responsive. It's marginally responsive. I think it's mostly unresponsive, to be honest. And it is clearly literally true, and there is no way to figure out that you're gonna have to follow up and that you're gonna have to probe more deeply. So these sorts of issues, I think, make it much more difficult. The fact that it's fine to say that if an answer is unresponsive, you have to probe more deeply, but where you cannot tell that an answer is unresponsive, I think the rule starts to break down. Now, how do we explain this sort of situation? Why is this so deceptive? I think we have to connect here a bit, once again, with the maxim of relation. The fact of the matter is that Grice's maxim of relation simply has to operate in the courtroom. There's been some debate about the extent to which these maxims operate in courtrooms, in court, during cross-examination, and so forth. And I think they may operate more weakly, but if you cannot assume that an answer is providing information is somehow relevant to the question, communication pretty much completely breaks down, right? So the maxim of relation must work to some extent. Now, it turns out that's not really the end of the Bronson case or the analysis of it. I could go on for quite a while. I'll try not to overdo it. But you could also see this, the you, as referring both to Bronson and to his company. And in that case, the question that would have been asked during that little exchange would be something like, have you or your business ever had accounts in Switzerland, right? And then Bronson would say the business had an account there for 6 months. Now notice that puts a slightly different twist on it, because in this case, the answer is responsive. I mean, it gives at least some information towards the question. But it doesn't give as much information as you might normally expect, right? So this seems, at least to some extent, to violate the maxim of quantity, that you should give enough information for purposes of the exchange, one of Grice's other maxims. Although, when you start looking at the maxim of quantity a little more carefully, it turns out that's a little bit problematic sometimes, too. If you look, for example, in your handout number 12, okay, let's say you ask, do you have any children? And the answer is, I have a son, Dick, and a daughter, Jane, but I've also got a son, Rambo, who's a juvenile delinquent, who I don't like to mention. Okay? Have I lied? Just out of curiosity, how many of you would think that answer is a lie? Small number. How many think it's misleading, but not a lie? How many think it's not even misleading? It's perfectly fine. Nothing wrong with it. A few nihilists in the crowd. Anyway, all right, now, what if I were to ask, how many children do you have? Okay? And then the answer is, I have a son, Dick, and a daughter, Jane, and I, once again, don't mention Rambo. How many people then think that would be a lie? Quite a few more. So you see, what's very relevant here is the question that you ask. Remember, the maxim of quantity says give enough information. What's enough? Well, in these question-answer sequences, what's enough depends upon the nature of the question. What the questioner seems to be seeking is very important in deciding whether that particular maxim has been violated. So, seems to be the maxim of quantity clearly operates in the courtroom as well, but probably a little more strictly in the sense that you look much more closely at the exact question. All right, I'm going to move along here so we don't get too far behind, because the really what I'd like to end up with is to apply some of these principles to the most interesting perjury case in the last decade or two, and that is the case of President Clinton, who, as you all know, was impeached in large part because he was accused of committing perjury during the case against him by Paula Jones for sexual harassment. And in that case, he was placed, remember you have to be under oath, he was placed under oath during the deposition by the lawyers of Paula Jones. And then later, he was placed under oath again when Ken Starr was doing his investigation of whether he'd lied during that deposition. So there are these two opportunities to see what he said under oath. What he said to his wife privately is not perjury, right? That would just be whatever it is. All right. One of the big issues, I can't go through all of it, obviously, because of lack of time, was how often he and Monica Lewinsky were alone. And this was asked during the Jones deposition. It's your handout. It's in your handouts on number 13. The lawyer asks, at any time were you and Monica Lewinsky together alone in the Oval Office? Answer, I don't recall. It seems to me she brought me things once or twice on weekends. In that case, whatever time she would be there, drop it off, exchange a few words, and go. She was there. All right. Well, during his grand jury testimony, when the truth sort of had come out, he was quite a bit more forthcoming. And at that point, he admitted pretty much that he and Lewinsky had been alone for probably around 10 to 15 times. So has he made a false statement here? Right? It turns out that it is, you notice the answer is at least partially responsive, right? The question relates to how often they were alone, and he talks about some times that they were alone. So it does, it's relevant, it's at least relevant. At the same time, of course, it's highly incomplete. He doesn't mention all these other times that they were alone. But if you look closely at the question, you'll notice, and as I said, I think you have to look very closely at the question here. The question it seems to be one that asks for a yes or no answer, right? And as such, arguably, when he gives at least some information that indicates they were alone, he is giving at least a somewhat positive answer. He's certainly not denying it directly. He's giving at least somewhat of a positive answer to that question. So I would say at this point, we haven't crossed the line. We haven't gotten a false statement necessarily yet. But it should be up to a good lawyer to now try to pin him down a little bit, right? Because he's been rather vague to find out whether that was the only occasion on which they were alone. The lawyer tries to do that, but he doesn't really do a horribly good job. But he tries again on number 14, where he tries to summarize. There are a few more interchanges like this. So as I understand, your testimony is that it was possible then that you were alone with her, but you have no specific recollection of that ever happening. Answer, yes, that's correct. It's possible that she, while she was working there, brought something to me, and at that time she brought it to me. She was the only person there. That's possible. Now, this answer, I've got to say, bothers me a bit more than the previous one, because here it's that saying it's possible, and that once again relates to Grice's maxim of quantity, which says that generally, if you can make a statement, you know, an assertion directly, you ought to say it directly. And that if you say maybe the following happened, right, by hedging, that's generally taken as being the strongest form of assertion that you can make. You know, on the other hand, it is true that everything that happens is also possible, right? So in a very literalistic way, I suppose you could say that that's true, but it seems to me that is at least fairly a misleading type of answer for him to have given. Whether it's technically perjury or not, I don't know. Maybe the lawyer should have probed a little more deeply. Now, the other very interesting line of questioning goes into is questions about whether they had sexual relations. And everyone here over 18 or otherwise have their parents' permission. Anyway, all right, I'll assume you are. So what about all of this discussion about sexual relations? Now, it's interesting. You have to look very carefully at how this arose. Most people just got bits and pieces in the newspaper. But during the deposition, when Clinton was deposed in the Paula Jones case, His own lawyer, at one point, asked him about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. Exactly why the lawyer did this, I don't know. And he asked about an affidavit that Lewinsky had made sometime earlier, which he had. So this is now Clinton's lawyer asking him in handout number 15. In paragraph 8 of her affidavit, she says this: I have never had a sexual relationship with the president. Is that a true and accurate statement as far as you know? And Clinton says, that is absolutely true. Okay. Now, the fact is that it seems quite clear that he at least engaged in oral sex with her, right? So, at any rate, this was held to be one of the cases where he very clearly lied. Now, not surprisingly, the lawyers for Ken Starr, when they asked him about the deposition, Jones' deposition, asked him about this interchange, right? They thought that this was perjury. And Clinton had, I think, a very interesting answer. And I'd like to show you, if I can, him doing that, but I'm not sure that I can get, how do I, let's give it a try and see if I can get this going. And if not, that's fine. Because I have a little video clip. Well, otherwise you've got it on your handouts. But it's sort of nice to hear that, you know, get it straight from the horse's mouth. Yeah, this one off. Did it power down?
Might have. Can you see where I can't really see here?
We might just get it, but
I can't. I'll see where it's
on. It was on. Home?
Mm-hmm. And do you see projector there?
No. Well, yeah, we had it going earlier, but we may just not be able to see this. Well, that's life. Anyway, basically his answer is a very interesting one where he essentially said, you've probably all had a chance to read it now. Essentially what he's saying is that when she made that statement, that she was using the ordinary definition of sexual relations, right? And he's saying that if you ask an ordinary person out there on the street if people having oral sex had engaged in sexual relations, that many of them, or most of them, would say no. And that is how he interpreted the term sexual relations when she was using it. Well, linguistically speaking, of course, that's an interesting linguistic sort of argument, right? That we're dealing with the ordinary meaning of the term, and if you were to ask a representative sample of people, that is how they would understand the term. There were, in fact, a couple of researchers who at one point did some research, and they interviewed college students, a rather suspect group when it comes to these sorts of issues, I think. But nonetheless, they interviewed college students, and they found that if they asked them, if you have oral sex with someone without intercourse, right, would you call that having sex? And 60% said no, that would not be having sex, which is very similar to having a sexual relationship. So I don't know. I don't want to argue that Clinton was right about his definition as to what the ordinary usage is or wrong. It's just very interesting here that he's making sort of a linguistic type of argument by appealing to the ordinary usage of the word. Now, of course, the lawyers for Paula Jones weren't complete idiots, and they realized that Clinton was a very sharp person. He was a lawyer, and so they thought, well, we're going to have to try to pin down this wily witness. They knew they were going to be asking him about sexual relations. So what they did, and I don't think it was a very good decision, but here's what they did. This is on your handout number 17. they decided to give him a written definition of sexual relationship or sexual relations. So for purposes of this definition, a person engages in sexual relations when the person knowingly engages in or causes contact with the genitalia, anus, groin, breast, inner thigh, or buttocks of any person with an intent to gratify or arouse, and so forth. And contact includes intentional contact, touching, either directly or through clothing. Now, this definition is not, you know, a dictionary definition. This is a descriptive definition. This is what linguists would call a prescriptive definition, or what I've called declaratory definitions in my book on legal language. It basically stipulates how the language must be used and understood. And they're very often used in statutes. For purposes of this statute, the word, you know, whatever means so-and-so. Now, Clinton, interestingly enough, he examines this definition, having been a lawyer, very carefully, and then he testified, when being questioned by the Jones lawyers, that under this definition, he had never engaged in sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky. Now, was that denial a false statement, right? Starr's lawyers, Kenneth Starr, certainly thought so, and examined him quite a bit on this during his grand jury testimony. And here's what Clinton had to say in your handout on number 18. He said, yes, I can tell you what my understanding of the definition is. I can't do a Clinton imitation, really. My understanding of this definition, as it covers contact by the person being deposed with the enumerated areas, if the contact is done with an intent to arouse or gratify. Okay, that doesn't tell us too much. What do you believe it to include or exclude? What kinds of activities? I thought the definition included any activity by the person being deposed where the person was the actor and came in contact with those parts of the bodies with a purpose or intent of gratification and excluded any other activity. So he argued essentially that because Lewinsky engaged in oral sex on him, her lips touched his relevant body parts, right, and not vice versa, that therefore she had engaged in oral sex with him under the definition, but he had not engaged in oral sex with her. Now, a lot of people thought that this distinction was absurd, of course. How can a woman have sexual relations with a man and a man not have sexual relations with a woman? And in fact, the grand jury asked about this, and Clinton's response is also in your handouts. You know, the grand jury would like to know, Mr. President, why it is that you think that oral sex performed on you does not fall within the definition. Because that is, if the deponent is the person who has oral sex performed on him, then the contact is with, not with anything on that list, but with the lips of the other person. It seems to be self-evident that that's what it is. And I thought it was curious. But let me remind you, sir, I read this carefully. I thought about it. I thought about what contact meant. I thought about what intent to arouse or gratify meant and so forth. Well, you know, if Clinton is being truthful about what actually happened, and in fact, there are some of Monica Lewinsky's testimony about what happened suggests that this distinction he's trying to draw might not in actual practice have been true in all cases. You can ask me about that later if you want to. But anyway, but notice here that you know, technically, he might very well be correct, right? The definition is written like this statute. Clinton does what many lawyers do when they read statutes. He picks it apart piece by piece. He interprets every word very literally in search of a loophole, and he might very well have found one. Anyway, Clinton tried, obviously. He knew about the Bronson literal truth defense, and he tried very hard to stay within the truth defense while at the same time admitting as little as possible or even at sometimes misleading his antagonist. Did he succeed? I think actually, if you look at these examples and others, that he didn't lie nearly as much as a lot of people seem to think. But on the other hand, when you're trying to follow that line and not go over it, and it's a wavy line sometimes, he did cross over this rather thin line that separates truth from falsity, I think, on at least a few occasions. Well, as you can see, there are a lot of interesting issues, a lot of interesting linguistic issues in the criminal law. There are some other issues I haven't had much time to talk about, One is the use of linguistic expertise in the courtroom. That's actually something that a lot of linguists have written about, and quite a few linguists actually have also done that. It's sometimes called the field of forensic linguist. The interpretation of criminal statutes, also a very big area, and also one where linguists might at some point have something to say about. The interpretation of legal documents more generally, of course, also very interesting. It's something actually that Professor Kaplan has written about. So what I've talked about today has really only just scratched the surface. But I do hope I've given you sort of a reasonably representative and reasonably interesting overview of how linguistics can help us better understand the legal system. And maybe linguistics can even help us make that system better. I guess we have some time for questions still. There's no clear distinction. In fact, the word lie is not really a legal concept. The legal question is the making of a false statement, right? So you have to make a material statement under oath that you do not believe to be true.
So prevarication would basically be a misleading statement?
It would probably be considered, yeah, merely misleading. Now, it turns out that misleading someone can be illegal, but it's just not perjury. So if you mislead someone, for example, with misleading advertising, right, that's outlawed by statute, for example, or it could be a type of fraud. So that's not to say that misleading or prevarication or something like that might not be problematic in other areas of the law. It simply is not something that you could be sent to prison for 5 years because it's not perjury. Yeah. Well, now, when you start looking more closely at these, you begin to realize it's all much more complex, right? There are a lot of complexities in here. Now, if you look at example 14, yeah, if you analyze it, if he starts out by saying, yes, that's correct, if he stopped there, that would have been, I think, a false statement, right? Because he says, your testimony is it's possible that you were alone with her, but you have no specific recollection of that ever happening. I would think that it would be almost, and Clinton apparently has a very good memory. I would think, and he didn't have sex with many interns, you know, you would think, maybe he did this every day, maybe he forgot Monica, but, you know, clearly he remembered it. So for him to deny that he had no specific recollection of it happening strikes me as extremely impossible. Right? Now, people can block things out sometimes, unpleasant memories and so forth, but I doubt that happens here. So if he stopped there, I think that would have been a false statement. But notice that he keeps on talking. He sort of qualifies that answer by saying it's possible that she brought things by me and when she was there, she was there. So what he's done is, he's effectively answered only the first part of the question. You see, and I think that the lawyer at that point should have followed up then and said, yes, I asked you whether you had any specific recollection of that. I wasn't asking just about what was possible. You're saying you have no specific recollection of that at all, that she was ever alone with you? That would have allowed him to pin it down, but he dropped the ball, I think, on numerous occasions during the Jones deposition. But, you know, Clinton also was a very sharp witness, and it's very hard to really effectively question or cross-examine someone who's as smart as he is, and is also a lawyer. Yeah.
Do you think that the second question in 14 has to do with in 13 where he asked if they were alone in the Oval Office specifically?
Mm-hmm.
In the second question, he doesn't ask if you were alone in the Oval Office, but it does seem to me like a follow-up of the first question.
Yeah.
So, if Clinton were making the argument that he's assuming that the question is about the Oval Office, that would change the relevance of his answer in 14.
That's right, Mike. And there's a lot of discussion about where exactly these things happened and what the scope was. Another quite a sort of issue that Clinton used in his
defense was, well, we were never alone. You see, the White House always has, they've got the Marines down the hall, So what's the scope of alone, right? And Betty Curry was, you know, around the corner from there. Yes.
Work, and that you could argue that suggestion maybe should turn it on.
You expect the Trump to be open.
natural space for a car counting that can be open, but it's not a natural space for a machine to work.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it's hard to say, but I would think that if you were, I'm not very good at coming up with an example right on the spot, maybe someone else can, but, you know, if you're standing around and everything, people are digging a hole to plant a tree or whatever, someone holds a shovel, and you can say, does that shovel work? But that could certainly be a suggestion. Maybe you'll have to get work, you know, do your share, right? Pitch in. Right? Or if you've got a mechanical auger standing there, someone says, does that auger work? I can see that would be a suggestion. They got to bring it over and start using it.
But why do you need this form instead of using the other indirect question?
This, well, it turns the Bustamante case is quite unusual in that sense. I've looked at quite a few of these, and the data, of course, are published opinions, so that's a limited set. But this is the only example I found of a police officer says that the triangle. That's always, almost always they're asking, the do you mind is by far the most common. But you also find some may I look in the trunk. But those are the two, by far, the most common formulations. You also get, you know, this is a little more coercive, yeah, you don't mind if I look in the trunk, do you? Right? And that's also helpful to be voluntary if someone then says yes. Whereas I think there ought to be an absolute prohibition on these tags, these negative tags. But anyway. Yeah?
Oh, I was looking at number 12, and the attorney says, do you have any children? And he says, I have a son, Dick, and a daughter, Jim.
Well, this is a hypothetical.
Okay, it's hypothetical. Because I got in a little trouble in court once. Someone asked me something, a question, and I gave an explanatory answer instead of saying yes or no. This attorney got very excited, and he yelled at the judge. He said, would you instruct the witness if she is to say yes or no? And of course, my goal in the situation was to protect myself, and without explanation, my yes answer or my no answer implicated something different than what I believed to be the truth. Hmm. So.
Well, if that's a legal issue, I ought to charge you.
I'm just saying, I didn't know this was hypothetical, but he's saying, you know, to me, that even though he maybe should have said more, I'm surprised the attorney didn't jump on
him
and say, you can't.
It's a little bit surprising. Were you involved in the case or just a witness?
Oh, I was involved.
Okay.
But I was not the.
Were you being questioned by your own lawyer or were you being cross examined? Or was it a friendly lawyer or?
Cross examined.
Essentially being cross examined. Okay, yeah. So, you know, there on the cross examined. Under cross-examination, the lawyer has some of the more flexibility as to how they go. Technically, in this question and answering sequence, usually lawyers, when they have to call the witnesses that they call, and certainly their own clients when they're going to call them, they explain to them what the questioning process is going to be like.
Right.
And they do tell them very clearly, like, you must listen to the question. And if I ask you a yes or no question, say yes or no, and don't say anything else. Because they don't want you volunteering information, right? The point of questioning in the courtroom is not to obtain information from your own clients. It is not to obtain information from your own clients. You already want to know what the answer is. You're simply bringing it out to the jury. And so you're very concerned that your witness is going to start, if they start talking and volunteering information, they're going to be saying things that could end up damaging their case. And so that may have been the lawyer's concern here, is just wanting to get a yes-no question of some of these things.
No, he was my antagonist.
Yeah. Well, and if I had been cross-examining you, then I would have said the same thing. If I, you know, I said, I don't want a yes or no answer to that question. And you were saying, I can't give a yes or no answer to that question. It isn't that simple, right, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then do your best. And what did the judge do? Did he say you have to say yes or no?
He did at first, but he got a little tired
of
the guy after
a few minutes. Well, he's not like an asshole, I'm not surprised.
I sort of have a follow-up to that. I guess you could choose any one of these, maybe two or
I'm open, go ahead and pick one.
Where can a person be compelled to give the right answer when you know what the person asking the question actually is asking about? So there ways that we can compel the...
Yeah. I mean, that's your job as a good lawyer, right? So if you say, do you have a Chevy? And your answer is, I have a Ford. You know, then I would say, well, that's not what I asked you, right? I asked, do you have a Chevy? Yes or no?
And they couldn't keep responding, I have a Ford.
No, at some point they would be answering the question, they could be held in contempt. Yeah.
I mean, I wonder if the answer to the why question, why didn't you come to work yesterday?
Yeah, that seems somewhat, and your claim that you can't tell whether it's responsive or not when you're asking the question, that seems right. But isn't this more clearly a case of lying than any of the others?
I tend to agree with that. I'm not entirely sure why, but I do tend to think that's right.
I guess my intuition about it is it's sort of just like asking, it's answering the WH question, right? So it's a sort of, it's elliptical.
Yeah.
So when somebody asks you, what did you eat for lunch? And you say ham, that's elliptical for I ate ham for lunch. In this case, this is elliptical for the reason I didn't come to work yesterday.
Yes. I think that is the best explanation. That really is that you've got to basically take the question. It's not a question of implications, right? An implication here or relevance. You simply have to put the question and answer together into a single utterance. And when you do that, that utterance is false.
Right.
Yeah. No, I think that is probably, I thought a bit about this myself, and I think that is in fact the best explanation. That's why this one is somewhat different than the other. But it does illustrate that you can't tell whether something, the reason I like it, it goes against this notion, the Supreme Court's sort of blind assumption that lawyers will be able to see the answers unresponsive and probe more deeply. The fact is that sometimes you can't tell whether an answer is unresponsive, like these sort of examples. And that's the main purpose for that example. Yeah. Yes?
I'm a little confused about this make a difference if you had here actions or intonation, like when the police officer asks, does this truck open? And if his hand was on the car or on the trunk, that would mean like he was trying to open it during that time? Or?
Well, of course, all of these come out of court cases that are not usually recorded, right? In fact, I don't know how that particular colloquy got in there. I presume at some point the police officer was testifying, and the lawyer said, what did you say, right? Well, how well do you remember, right, something like that word? I mean, that's one big issue. But maybe they just routinely ask in the same way all the time. Because the intonation can make a big difference. I mean, obviously, gestures, intonations, and all of the gestures can sort of threatening, right? And the way that you ask a question can be, you don't mind if I have a look at that trunk, do you? You know, I mean, that's a little different from, would you mind if I have a look at your trunk, right? So, but that's not, of course, doesn't show up in the written text. Now, there are more and more police officers and more and more police cars that have a small video camera nowadays, which I think also records sound. So we may start getting video of these, not very good quality, but we may start getting video of these things, and that would give you some more information.
So if the police officer does not have the right to ask you to open the trunk, that at the border, always becomes a little...
The border is a different situation.
They always tell you, they don't ask you.
No, you don't have the right. You have everything right to the border. Just forget the Constitution. Leave the Constitution behind. They can pretty much do what they want, in certain limits. Yes?
I have a question about, of course, the practicality, about the title of the language and all that. I mean, do you go to court and testify, or people go to questions doing that, or how does the linguist come in here?
Well, that gets to the question of linguistic expertise and the function of linguistic courtroom. I don't really testify an awful lot. I just prefer to sit in my office and close the door and write. But I do sometimes, but not usually on these sorts of questions. These cases, like if you're talking now about whether the meaning of the request to counsel and that sort of thing, I've converted cases where linguists were involved. And in fact, talking to some groups of lawyers, I found that most of them have very little idea what's going on here. Where you tend to find it most often is where you have people being read their Miranda rights or people being interrogated in another language. And so there, very often, you have interpreters coming in and people talking about whether that person, whether interpreted correctly, right, that's often a big issue, or if the person who speaks limited English, whether it's someone, if the Miranda warning was given in English, would that person have been able to understand it? And here, you know, we talk about this in our book as well, but the general standard is that if you sort of understand what the words mean, then the warning is effective. But you don't have to understand the implication, the legal implication of the warning, which in fact is the most important thing about it. Right? There's been quite a bit of, there have been some linguists who testified in cases that involve threats, was it a threat, was it not a threat, those sorts of cases. And but a lot, an awful lot of the work has been recently on things like the analysis, voice analysis, right? Phoneticians get involved in this, where they get like tape-recorded threats by telephone or something like that. And what is it? The defendant's person is that the voice of the tape, right? So that's a fairly large deal. And this opposite identification is becoming larger, so who wrote that threatening note, right? And doing some sort of analysis on that. It's tricky still, that it's difficult to do that, although the samples are small, and there are a lot of other issues. But that's a fairly common issue as well. All right, well, thank you for having me.
This is our lunch break now.